from other decades and eras. There's a Facebook page for the Bedazzled Radio Hour.
We're a thousand miles from comfort. We could travel land and sea. But as long as you are with me, there's no place I'd rather be.
Hey, it's Gracie,
Sarah,
and Josie
from the Girl Scout Troop 1819, Coxsackie, Athens.
And you're listening to
WGXC ACRA at 90.7 FM.
Keep on being you.
Oh, honey, I want to go upstate where the 20-somethings are covering themselves with their canvases in their car to keep warm during those cold summer nights. I want to go up to that Rev where that Jerry is. Wow, he's a real pistol. He's going to tell me a funny story and then get a biscotti from the old sliding glass case. Why do you sound like a pirate, honey? Oh, when I go to Hudson, I feel like a pirate. Oh, honey, I love seeing all the people frolicking in the fields with their mushroom patch. Oh, I get some of those mushrooms and get over to the St. Charles and start one of them whoop-de-doo parties. Battlefield Earth, every Tuesday from 9:30 to midnight.
WGXC underwriting support is provided by the Healthcare. Underwriting support is provided by the Healthcare Consortium, a rural health network dedicated to improving access to healthcare and supporting the health and well-being of the people in our rural community. Throughout 2018, the Healthcare Consortium will be celebrating 20 years of serving the residents of Columbia and Greene counties. To learn more about the Healthcare Consortium and its services, please visit www.columbiahealthnet.org. Or call 518-822-8820.
Good afternoon, and welcome to WGXC's At Issue. My name is John Kane. I'm your host today. I am here with Amanda Purcell from the Register Star and Carolyn Riggs, campaign manager for the Aidan O'Connor campaign. Welcome, ladies. I've been looking forward to this show for some time. I've actually really been looking forward to the midterm elections for some time. It's like the season finale of a really interesting TV show. And let's break down what happened this season. So a lot of people got out and voted. Amanda, you were out at a lot of polling places yesterday.
Yeah, so we had we made an effort to go to both sides, the Greene County and Columbia County. We went to Coxsackie Town Hall, and we went... We started in Valencia with, or Kinderhook with Representative Fazzo, who voted around 9 a.m. And then we hit some polling places in Hudson. And the biggest thing to come out of it was just the large turnout. And people continually said that they'd never seen the parking lot that full, not even for the presidential election. But the numbers certainly proved that.
Yeah, I was asking everybody, you know, are you going to vote? Are you going to vote? It's really important that you go to vote. Make sure you go to vote. And there was only one person who said that they weren't going to vote. And he just said, oh, I don't really care about this, any of this. I didn't expect that I was going to lose it on him, but I lost it on him. I was like, how dare you? Do you know how many thousands of people have died for your right to vote? This is the future of your country. And you don't, and I just went, I mean, I just sounded like a crazy old man. But I only had to do that once this year. Everybody else was really engaged. They knew their candidates. They knew their issues. What did you find on Greene County versus Columbia County?
It was interesting. Seeing the two different counties, and Greene County typically swings Republican, and then you come to Columbia County, Hudson usually swings blue. But Greene County, people were just like really excited to talk about the race. I mean, no matter which political candidate they were rooting for, they were excited to talk about it. I ran into one guy who was really excited about Larry Sharp for the governor race, and he he had actually gone to pretty much any speaking engagement he could for Larry Sharp as well as for Mark Molinaro. So he was really excited about learning whatever he could about the candidates. So it was interesting. I met a few Delgado supporters and people who were really gung-ho about Delgado. And then there were a lot of people who maybe didn't want to express their support publicly, but they were in favor of keeping things the way that they are, is what I heard a lot of people say. So it's definitely interesting.
Interesting. Yep. Did you see a switch? I mean, you've lived in this area for how long?
Oh, gosh. Well, I grew up in Dutchess County, so you know, I've gone away and come back a few times. But, yeah, no, I mean, Columbia County is always interesting because it's sort of a swing county, they say. You know, it could go either way depending on turnout. And I think turnout really drives the end result, especially with this particular election. So,
yeah. I mean, certainly this was a midterm election, and I was just talking to our station manager before we started the show. Antonio Delgado got more votes than Zephyr Teachout. Got in a presidential year by a lot, actually, and she actually beat John Faso, who, as an incumbent, drew fewer votes than she did by several thousand, I think, which is very interesting. I think that this was just as much a referendum on John Faso as it was, you know, people were gung-ho about Antonio Delgado. I think a lot of us, after this very protracted primary, you know, a lot of us had, you know, you were with Brian Flynn. I was kind of maneuvering around to different candidates, but I never really landed on Antonio. So I think a lot of people after the Democratic primary were very sort of wishy-washy in their support. And I think I was a little surprised at the strength of the turnout for him. I mean, people really did kind of fall in line this year.
I would say, too, we did get a few supporters who were looking for the anti-Faso candidate. It didn't really matter who that was, but then there were a lot of people who really had signed on to Delgado's message too. So you definitely got both of those types.
Yeah, I saw them both at a debate, and I have to say that Delgado, I always thought that he was a very smart, cogent. You know, he was well spoken, but he didn't seem to connect quite as much at the beginning of this process as he did towards the end of the process. He seemed, even in the debates, he just seemed more relaxed. He seemed calmer. He seemed like he was engaging with the issues a little bit more than just sticking to his talking points. So there was definitely a curve for him. Carolyn, you had probably one of the most difficult races to manage this year. It did not go, I think, the way that you guys had hoped. Aidan O'Connor came within 161 votes during the special election in April. And he lost by 7,000 to 8,000. We're predicting
the count's around 7,000. Right,
7,000, and that's a very tough district. That is the Assembly 102nd, and that includes
all of Greene and Schoharie counties, and parts of Columbia County, mm-hmm. Albany, Otsego, Delaware, and one town in Ulster.
That's an extremely conservative, except for the one town in Ulster. That's an extremely conservative.
Very much so. Donald Trump took it, the district, in 2016 by 22 points, and Romney won in the year previous, presidential year previous, by 5 points. So it's a very deep red assembly district.
And yet, Democrats are starting to pay attention to this district. I mean, the idea, I think, with the special election was, if anybody can do this, Aidan O'Connor can do this. So first, I guess my first question is, what is it that the Democrats are looking for in these deep red districts to make them competitive? What are they looking for in candidates?
Yeah, well, that's a great question. I think the debate is ongoing, to be truthful. Aidan was an outstanding, really kind of nonpartisan candidate. He did share, a lot of Democratic values, but he also shared a lot of, conservative Republican values because he was, grew up in Durham and in the heart of this district. And so he brought a lot of crossover appeal, being on the Democratic Working Families and WEP line. And I think that because of that, we did see some crossover appeal. You know, this district is predominantly Republican with about 31,000 Republican registered voters, about 20,000 Democrats, and about 20,000 unaffiliated. So we were really walked into this race outnumbered. And because we were down by 11,000 votes on the onset, we really had to look at the no party, the unaffiliated, and the minor party voters to try and engage them. Mm-hmm. And based off of the numbers, we saw crossover. We saw people get behind Aidan's message, and we're really pleased with the result because we know that this is a long game, that we have more work to do, and we'll continue to fight the good fight.
So, I mean, tell me, Aiden came into this as somebody who has appeal for conservatives. Did that cost him appeal with more progressive voters? I mean, does he just take up a different part of the spectrum? I've met Aiden. I like Aiden. In full disclosure, I volunteered for Aiden. I was making phone calls for Aiden. I swooned over his little picture with a first responder.
As everyone else.
Yeah, no. I don't know if you've seen it. It's very swoonable. he looked really good. I mean, you know, do we put him up again and hope for a demographic shift? Clearly he has a future in the Democratic Party. You know, is this an impossible district to win for a number of years?
Yeah, that's all great questions. So I think, you know, Aiden needs to take some time and evaluate what he wants to do. You know, he's a handsome young man, but very smart, and he's given back to our community from all of his life. And so I think he'll continue to do that in whatever capacity that he sees fit at the time, whether that's running for office again, running for the assembly, or running for something else. I think he's got his sights set on, you know, continuing to do the work of his community and putting his neighbors and his friends, you know, and even his enemies first.
Are there some local issues like the jail that muddied the waters for the campaign?
I wouldn't think so. You know, he's been really open and transparent about his point of view on the jail issue in Greene County. And he's also been very open to having conversations from, you know, the opposition. He voted no on the jail issue, but he was actively engaged in the conversation with people who were, you know, 100% behind it. And I think that conversation will continue. You know, his term finishes at the end of this year, so he'll continue serving through the year. And then he'll, you know, I'm sure be, you know, a participant in the process moving forward.
So let's take a look at some of the other races that were happening around, particularly, you know, the Delgado race as it relates to some of the other races down the ballot. You know, one of the things that I had heard just talking sort of offhand to people in a number of the other smaller races is that the Delgado campaign maybe wasn't great to coordinate with at all times. You had, you know, Delgado at the top of the ballot, and you want him to pull everybody, you know, and you would like that line A all the way. Could there have been more done to coordinate?
I mean, in my experience, you know, I've been doing this for a long time, and I've worked at different levels of races, and the level of coordination that happened across the 19th Congressional District, underneath the state party's coordinated campaign, and working with all the Assembly and Senate races was actually the most coordinated effort that I have been a part of since I started this. And a lot of that came down to our ground game. And there's only a certain amount of human resources a campaign can recruit to knock on doors or to make phone calls or to write postcards. And what the coordinated campaign allowed us to do was to actually concentrate those resources, so an individual who wanted to go knock on a door for the congressional candidate could also knock on the door and tout their assembly or their Senate race. So
I have to say, though, like, I spectacular. See, but that's interesting because I actually wanted to do this for Aaron Glad, and for, you know, when I was working with Aiden, I didn't see any of that. I mean, I saw the signs in the office, but going out or making phone calls, I didn't know anything about any of the other candidates. And that's, you know, maybe that's just a reality that, you know, you're here calling for this candidate, please just call for this candidate. Like, we need these votes too.
Yeah, and I think it may have varied across the district in different ways with different races. I know that in our experience with Aiden's campaign, you know, we worked really closely with Pat Strong and Joyce St. George and Aaron Glad, you know, who were our three Senate races that overlapped our assembly district. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, I was in communications with, you know, the field organizers and the field directors from the Delgado campaign pretty consistently enough to know exactly where they were, what they were doing, what the script was reading, you know, the conversations we were having. So I think we can always do better, but I think for the first year that this region has really seen such a coordinated effort, I think we've learned a lot from it, but I also think we did a pretty outstanding job with what we had.
Sure, sure. Amanda, polling was showing Faso in the lead until very recently. He got trounced last night by a lot. What do you think is what do you think the big problem here is? What is the disconnect between the polling and the reality?
You know, that's a difficult question. That's something that sort of came up with the President Trump's election too. It's definitely, you know, at what point do you take the polls with a grain of salt? But there was a lot of sort of excitement for Delgado, and I think that just for whatever reason didn't register in the numbers. But you could hear it from the people that we spoke to. I don't really know what the answer is to that. Wouldn't that be interesting if we
has polling changed in the last couple of years, Carolyn?
I think it has quite substantially. I think that enough voters are now attuned to those calls when they receive them. I spoke with several voters who spoke and said, oh yeah, I got that call and I messed up, you know, I messed with my answers to screw with the poll.
Nobody ever calls me. I just have to point it, like, nobody, and I don't know if this is because I have a San Francisco cell phone number.
Probably, and
my phone is actually from Hawaii, but nobody ever, like, I've lived in this district, I'm registered, like, I've gone to jury duty, somebody call me, ask what
you're
I think.
You're like, please, yeah. You're one of the few who actually wants to get that call.
I don't want, I want to be wanted, I don't want to have to deal with the call.
Yeah, so it's interesting because it's a tactic, it's a tool in the tool belt for a campaign, is, you know, you can go all day long and you can get a certain amount of feedback. But there's only so many people home with the time you go. So what are the other ways you can kind of check the pulse of the electorate? Polling is one of those ways to do it. So it's not a be-all, end-all kind of tool that campaigns use, but it does help provide guidance in support, in name recognition, and also in messaging. You can test messaging. How is a voter going to respond to a specific phrase? There's a lot of science that goes behind the polling itself. I have actually seen the traditional phone bank calling, when you get a live call, transition to, you know, there was robocall, automated polling done this cycle pretty substantially in this district where, you know, they asked you a question and you pushed one for yes or two for no. There's also online polling that was introduced, which I think is where polling is actually going to move to, which provides an interesting predicament for us in the 102nd Assembly and across the western part of the 19th Congressional District, because there simply is no broadband and there's no access to the internet for a large number of the electorate. Right. So, you know, when you go into it, it says, how are you going to get a good strategic, you know, kind of snapshot of your electorate before you go out and, put into place all your paid communications to influence a vote? And you've got to look at who are you talking to, why are you talking to them, and then how are you actually talking to them.
You had pointed out, you and I were on the same thread in Facebook, and we were talking about social media marketing for campaigns. Mm-hmm. Specifically, we were talking about, you know, the fact that there is no real social media marketing in any of the campaigns in upstate New York. Could you expand on that a little bit?
That there isn't?
Done.
Okay, great. Moving on. It's interesting because
it's a low cost way to reach potential voters.
Absolutely,
you can
target.
I mean, you can geo target very specifically, and yet, on my Facebook, neither Antonio Delgado nor John Faso were anywhere to be found.
Well, it's interesting because digital advertising is actually a new tool in the toolbox. So I'll keep going back to that, but it's a new tool in the toolbox because. It wasn't really
is
used.
It really that new, though? I mean,
it is in the terms of political advertising, okay, and political outreach and messaging. We didn't really see it to the extent that we saw it until the 2016 cycle. In 2014, you know, Facebook banner ads or Google or YouTube or anything like that, it wasn't a thing that campaigns felt like we could access enough voters that would get their attention. The other thing, and this is something that I have struggled with, is what one of my former bosses, Brian Flynn, calls the campaign industrial complex. And there simply is not consultants who typically run campaigns, who manage the campaigns and the paid communications piece. There aren't enough of them who have transitioned into digital advertising, so they haven't figured out a way to make money from it. So they don't invest in digital ads because when they make money from the mail pieces or from the TV buys, they're making more money from that. And we have to remember that they're a for-profit corporation,
right,
who's working for the candidates. So there are actually a number of really great, digital ad firms that I've worked with on previous races. I worked with a couple of them on my races this last cycle here upstate New York. But I think there's room for a market. I think if someone is interested in diving in and offering that service, I think there absolutely is. But we go back to that social media thread and how effective, you know, is that dollar that you invest in digital advertising when you're only reaching 40% of the electorate because 60% doesn't have internet?
Right, but I mean, can't that be, I mean, is that 60% that doesn't have internet, do they also not have phones with Facebook on them? And I guess the other question is, are they also cut off demographically as an age group? You know, are they people who are 70 and older?
Yeah, I have never seen more people with flip phones ever.
I had a flip phone. So I have to say, I had a flip phone until about a year ago, and I desperately missed my flip phone.
Right?
Not only was it super cheap, I could lose it and be like, I don't care. Do you have $12? Let me just go run to the store and get another flip phone. You know, it was every time I had to charge that phone, I actually had to buy a new cord because it had been so long since I had charged my phone that I couldn't remember where on earth I could have possibly put the cord.
It's so simple.
It was once every 2 weeks. And the only problem was when you had to text. It was it took a really long time, and then people would get frustrated and be like, why aren't you answering me? I need you to and then you would. So, like, you kept trying to go back and
you're
answer them.
Five, just three times to get to the
yes,
to the M or
yes,
the N. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but you get fast at it.
So,
yeah,
so it's an interesting challenge, I think, is these new tools that are, you know, as you know, Mobilize America was a great tool for volunteer management and recruitment that a lot of campaigns across the nation used. This year, the Delgado campaign used Mobilize America. I think a couple of the state senate and assembly races did as well. And so there's a lot of technology advancements that are making our jobs as political operatives easier, but it's also about making sure that the electorate, that the volunteers, can also utilize and understand how to use those tools to be most effective. You know, in the 102nd Assembly District, there's a stretch of 145 for a good 25 minutes that there is nothing. There's no cell service. I don't even know if broadband is, you know, if internet is laid there. Mm-hmm. So you're talking about people who still have a landline. You know, I've got high school interns who don't know what a landline phone looks like. So the technological advancement gap that exists in some of these rural areas is an interesting challenge when you've got campaigns who can invest in the more technologically advanced tools.
Right. And I guess my question is, do people just not get the technology, or do they just not get the technology in the very convenient way that people living in the middle of Manhattan would get it? You know, when I would go to Woodstock, the reason that I had a flip phone was because I would go to Woodstock and my partner, like, nothing out there worked except for one phone company. So I had to buy a separate phone just for the time I was in Woodstock so that I could make phone calls and say, hey, where are you? What's for dinner? I'm locked out.
I mean, I know people who have an AT&T phone and a Verizon phone and... You know,
oh yeah, people thought I was a drug dealer all the time because I had different, yeah.
Some service works in different areas. But going back to, I think, to your original point is, you know, is there opportunity for, you know, someone to come in and support these local campaigns who don't have, you know, the financial resources to get behind a major firm, mm-hmm. but that can actually invest in a little bit of digital advertising that can actually communicate in a clear message or mirror or replicate what's happening in the mail or on the doors or on the stump even. And I think there is opportunity, and I think we'll continue to see that expand.
Maybe my mailbox won't be so stuffed with pieces from Antonio Delgado.
All the mail, really. But
yeah.
I use it as fire starter for the winter. It's like perfect transition time.
Yes.
From the end of the election season, you just have like a big stack of mail from everyone, and it's a great fire starter.
I've actually used those before. They are pretty good. I did that when Sean Eldridge was running.
I got a lot of mail from FASO. You know what was interesting is I didn't see a lot of the top of the ticket. The governors, the attorney generals, the comptroller, you know, those top of the ticket races. I didn't see a lot of work done in our region. And I don't even think I got one piece of mail from any governor candidate.
Nobody during the primary campaign, Gareth Rhodes had people knock on my door, and I like wandered out in the morning, like in my underwear with a coffee, and was like, "Go the hell away!" Like, slammed the door in their face. I have not had anybody knock on my door since, and I don't know if that's because like the entrance is a mess, or my 100-pound murder dog, or they're just like, "Hey, that's John Cain. He's not worth going to. He knows how he's voting." But I was not very harassed in person or by canvassers.
Were you grateful for that, or were you sad that you didn't?
I mean, I was grateful for that, but then I also feel a little rejected by that.
Well, I always tell people when we keep knocking on doors, knocking, or calling, and they say, "Oh, you know, I've got 5 phone calls today." And I said, "Well, obviously you're an important voter, but as soon as you commit,"
I do have to say that a lot of the calls that I made for campaigns before. Have been, these are going to be the people who are probably going to vote. They're like most likely to vote. And we just wanted to call them to make sure that they're going to the polls. And, you know, whenever you're making these phone calls, so maybe 25% of the phone numbers that you dial aren't there. Most of the other people you get voicemail, or they're just not there. Then if you do get someone, they probably don't want to talk to you. And as soon as you get halfway through the sentence, they're going to hang up. But if you do manage to get through the sentence and say, "Hey, I'm calling from Blah Bitty Blah's campaign. Have you heard of our candidate?" 90% of the time, their response from these lists is, "Yes, and I'm voting for them. Please stop calling me." And it's like, why do we keep... That's a lot of effort chasing those. You did hand me a list at Aidan O'Connor's campaign of, like, totally undecided people. Here are the challenging voters that we have to talk to. And that was like a fun challenge.
We call that in the campaign world the persuasion phase. And I think all the campaigns went through that through the summer and late into the fall. And then you do transition to, you know, your likely voters, to identify them and make sure that they, you know, they have everything they need. They don't have any questions about, you know, voting on election day, or, you know, if they need an absentee ballot. But I love the persuasion phase because it really gives myself, my staff, all the volunteers an opportunity to talk to someone who may not be like-minded. And it should make, I encourage everyone to get outside of their echo chamber, because we have to have real conversations with real people. We have to get offline. We have to go to the diners and sit in the back corner with the old timers who tell stories from the 50s, 60s, and 70s about life and, you know, in the area, because it makes the work that the people that you are working for at the time, the candidate, it makes them more enriched in understanding of the area that they want to represent, so that when they do get elected, they can be a true representative of their district.
Right. I mean, I think certainly in Hudson, you know, Amanda, you probably noticed this, we are absolutely in a bubble here. And just a few miles in any direction, you know, you run into a totally different world. As someone who has grown up in this area, you know, how do you see that change affecting people? Is it that there is a demographic shift going on because people are leaving and people are coming in? Is it that people who have lived here their entire life are slowly...
Columbia County, New York City becomes more and more expensive to live. People just from, you know, the lower counties are moving up here. I don't know that there is I think it comes down to voter turnout, to what I was saying earlier. You know, it really depends on showing up to the polls, how engaged the voters are. I think that really drives the decision. You know, it's sort of up in the air when we come to big election shifts like this, especially in terms, you know, we weren't expecting to have come out initially, but there was people who were engaged by the presidential, and that seemed to people to support their candidates more fervently than in years past. So, there's always been you know, this sort of especially in Hudson, look at people who have been here, who've lived here for generations, and then there's people coming in from the city. So, you know, there's always that. But again, it's really about who shows up to the polls, I think.
I mean, there seems to be certainly a switch towards the Democrats. The New York Times had an interesting piece that they had done about the way that the Democrats lost Missouri, and it was because They don't. One of the reasons, I'm sure it was a rich tapestry, was because they don't allow pro-life Democrats to really have a voice in the party anymore. And there were a lot of people in Missouri in the 90s who strongly identified as Democrats but were also pro-life. And when people started talking about banning the procedure that is also called partial birth abortion, that makes us all kind of squeamish. Like, you know, even if you are very pro-choice, it's a very squeamish story to have to listen to. You think, okay, this doesn't really make me comfortable anymore. And it might only happen when it's medically necessary, but it's, yikes, it just gives all of us a little bit of the heebie-jeebies to have to hear about it. You know, people who were pro-life Democrats in Missouri, who were very religious, you know, didn't feel like they had a place at the table anymore, because it was, we are pro-choice 100% of the way, right into the ninth month, and we've lost it. And so a lot of people on this very core issue to who they were, like this is an ethical, moral, you know, human rights issue, couldn't identify with the Democrats anymore, and so they switched their party affiliation, and the Democrats began to lose large swaths of rural areas outside of St. Louis. And, you know, and that's how the story goes. Is something similar happening now to Republicans?
You know, locally, I wouldn't say so. I mean, the biggest things that I heard from voters was healthcare and taxes. Those were the biggest things that I heard locally from people. People obviously want their taxes, their property taxes, and their state taxes to, you know, be manageable and be livable. I don't know if those big issues came into play this time around. But it was definitely, you know, definitely about healthcare in this time, especially in the congressional race. That was the big thing. I don't know that there, you know, we didn't really hear any of those things during the campaigns about any specific large issue like that. It's largely been limited to healthcare in general.
Certainly an important issue. Speaking of healthcare, now that the New York Democrats have the state Senate back, there is talk of a larger healthcare bill on the horizon, also possibly the legalization of marijuana for recreational use. Some bigger things on the plate. Would either of you care to voice any thoughts about that?
Without getting ourselves into trouble? Anyway.
Or with getting yourselves into trouble? I don't care. I'm not going to get into trouble.
I think Democrats turned out in big ways this year for the state Senate, and it's actually exciting. I think I saw something that this is only the second time in over 50 years that Democrats have controlled the Senate House in this state.
And they screwed it up pretty good last time.
Well, you know, no comment.
Yeah.
I wasn't here then, but I'm here now, and I look forward to seeing what the new Senate class brings to the table, I think, for a lot of issues, specifically in terms of healthcare. I think our state's going to have a really good debate about how the New York Health Act, as you know, proposed this last session, how it should be evolved to be an affordable and workable piece of legislation that really can benefit everyone across income level, geographic region. I think that the New York Health Act, as proposed right now, presents some tremendous challenges for us. And I think we need to look at how it's going to affect all income levels and specifically geographic areas. In Aiden's 102nd Assembly District, there's only two hospitals, and none of them provide any kind of critical care healthcare.
What is trauma? Did they just go to Albany Med?
Yeah, they have to be transported out of the district. So, I mean, if you have a heart attack or a stroke, you can't even give birth in that area. So they're being transported to Albany Med or Columbia Memorial Health over here in Columbia County. And I think that is one issue that's outside of making sure that everyone has health insurance. So I think we have to look at both the access and the affordability of it. And I think that the state Senate is in a really good position to be able to negotiate with the assembly on a sound piece of legislation that the governor could sign.
What is it that the Republicans can do now? What is their, what is the way that they can change their messaging and their identity here in upstate New York to draw voters back in?
Well, that's the million-dollar question, isn't it? you know, I can't say for certain what the game plan is, but you know, from the ads, I think people felt really disconnected from the ads this year. They were kind of over them, especially for the congressional race.
Are we talking the racist? Well, let's just call them the racist ads. I'll call them the racist ads.
You know, I think that turned off a lot of voters, and just a lot of the, you know, negativity. And I'm not saying it always has to be, you know, positive or this way or that way, but it's certainly, I think people were really turned off by that. Some people, even who didn't have a definitive look at the issues, they saw those ads and they said, nope, I'm not going to vote this way or that way based on that. And a lot of people too were concerned about the truthfulness of the ads as well. So that was another thing I heard from people.
When we're talking about the ads, are you specifically talking, because the only ones that really come to my mind are the
congressional race.
Are the congressional race and the rapper ads.
The rapper ads, yeah.
Yeah.
So, yeah, you had people strongly come out against those ads. So maybe it's a call back to talking about specific issues. Kind of get lost in the you know, the back and forth. But yeah.
It'll be interesting to see what direction they take. I mean, Molinaro, I think, would probably be a very interesting candidate for this congressional district in 2020. I suppose we shall see.
I'd like to finish the final vote count before we start talking about this election, before we start talking about 2020, but...
Party's over.
Maybe that's just me.
Right. You know, speaking of, ostensibly then, I suppose, we can say that, you know, with Cuomo having won re-election and the Democrats probably controlling both houses... going into 2020, redistricting is going to fall into the hands of Democrats. How is that going to change the look of districts in New York? What districts are going to disappear?
I can tell you locally in Hudson, it changed a lot when we did, when they, you know, redrew the ward lines. So I can only imagine what would happen at a larger level, it should be interesting to see if they do decide to go through with that, what's going to happen. So,
and I think something we have to remember is that we still have one more election before redistricting happens.
Yes.
So
yes, I mean, we have 2020, and then
so you know, this cycle was crucial and important at the national level, and at the local level as well, to take a, you know, a big giant step. But we have to remember that we have to, you know, in this state, we need to hold the line in 2020. So we're going to have to defend our Senate seats that we just won. We're going to have to defend our Assembly seats. We're going to have to be able to identify, you know, as Democrats, we have to identify, you know, Republican Senate and Assembly seats that that we can continue to recapture in 2 years from now. So, you know, I think that if we, you know, if we put the cart before the horse, you know, we forget to put the reins on and we get crazy. So I think we're going to see lines redrawn. I think we're going to see districts change dramatically.
And 2 years is, yeah. You're right, 2 years is a very long time from now. As I was watching President Trump's, I was watching what I could of President Trump's. I just couldn't watch the whole thing. I didn't have time. And I've been feeling a little under the weather already lately. But I was watching President Trump's press conference today after the election, and he was talking about, you know, all these investigations are going to happen. Well, I'm going to start investigating the Democrats in the House, and we're going to do this. We don't know what the world is going to look like in 2 years. I mean, is it going to be President Trump's re-election? It might be President Pelosi's re-election, and that would change that would change the drive of voters in upstate New York, I think, quite a bit.
Well, and I think there's actually tremendous opportunity for our state-level candidates to actually put into place some laws that can truly benefit, you know, the residents of their respective districts. I fear that with us having the majority in the U.S. House of Representatives now, is that we are going to be very focused on Trump and our president. And that attention is going to actually take away from what I would consider to be real work that needs to get done. There are a lot of people that are struggling in our communities.
What work is going to be able to get done, though, right? Because the Republicans still hold the Senate. Mitch McConnell does not like negotiating very much. His comment about Nancy Pelosi was, I'm familiar with her. I have met her before, and I'm sure that I will meet her again at some point in the future. Like, he did not have very kind words for Nancy Pelosi. President Trump is, of course, Donald Trump. So I don't see that even with a clear majority in the House, that the Democrats are going to be able to get anything done.
Well, I agree with you, and I think that's where the state level representation
right.
can step up for
right.
us, as you know, in New York is with a majority in the Senate and the Assembly, we can actually get some pieces of legislation that can actually benefit our residents, while the federal level continues to be kind of almost out of touch to a certain degree. Because I agree with you, I don't have much faith that much is going to get accomplished in the next 2 years.
I was talking to someone who was thinking about running for the state Senate seat that was abandoned by Kathy Marchione, and he was saying, you know, he was thinking about running for it, and he's like, you know, actually, to be able to go to Albany and actually get stuff done probably means that you've got more on your resume than going to Washington right now, because nothing is getting done in Washington. At least stuff is happening at the state level.
And I can say, too, you know, I spoke with Assemblymember Barrett today. I spoke with Daphne Jordan. And, you know, their message today wasn't, you know, anti or pro-Trump. They were specifically talking about what they wanted to do at the state level. Barrett was saying that she would like to focus on environmental issues and fossil fuels. And so she seemed pretty optimistic.
Does she feel like the state is going to be able to really focus on environmental issues?
She seems pretty adamant about it. That's what she's going to be focusing on, according to her. You know, I think that she according to her, you know, this is a real critical point to her, and it has to get done. So she seemed pretty determined to do it.
And I think without the EPA, I mean, that certainly seems like a challenge, you know.
Yeah, anything that would happen would probably happen on the state level, I would assume.
Right,
yeah.
The DEC.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, which they do get a lot done. I, you know, if you've ever tried to go swimming in the Ashokan Reservoir, you know that the DEC, they're out there and they're certainly watching. Turning our attention away from New York for just a second, let's talk about some of the bigger surprises nationwide. I grew up in Texas, and so I was kind of quietly pulling for Beto O'Rourke. I didn't think that he was going to do it. But I thought that he made a pretty good showing. You know, when I grew up in Texas, we had Ann Richards, and we were a pretty purple state with a different kind of Republican value than I think that what you have now. But certainly I think that some more attention is probably going to be paid now by Democrats to red states like Texas, especially large metropolitan red states like Texas. Is that... I'm looking to you, Carolyn.
I mean, I agree. I watched several of the Texas races from afar. I was pretty tunnel visioned in on New York and upstate New York specifically. I think what we fail to forget is when you look at a state or even just a district that's, you know, 20, 30, 40 points, you know, to the other major party, you know, to completely flip that district is, you know, seemingly impossible. Mm-hmm. And so being able to look at those numbers and look at the work that Beto did is for me, it gives me tremendous hope for future progress. And we can take the work that he's done there and continue to push forward with, you know, the next candidate, you know, in 4 years.
And I'm assuming that there was probably some help down ballot that he gave to Democrats, so the Democrats in more metropolitan areas, it might be tilt slightly more to the left anyway, probably got a boost from his presence on the ticket, because they probably just right across the entire...
Yeah, I think candidates like him are exciting, not just for the party's base, but I think they are exciting for no party registered voters and unaffiliated voters, especially when your alternative is a long-term incumbent who really hasn't done anything for you as the individual. So being able to, you know, approach the race from an as a registered unaffiliated, not interested in party, looking for their person who can best represent them, I think Beto provided that opportunity for them, which energized, you know, vote unlikely voters. So not only did he, you know, push the base up, but he also energized people who haven't voted before. We saw that in 2016. We saw it again this year. I think we'll continue to see that kind of work.
You know, it's funny to me because in my Facebook account, I grew up in Houston, which is a fairly liberal area, but, you know, I had some fairly conservative friends, and I saw a lot of my friends' Beto ads. I didn't see anybody's Ted Cruz ads. And yet I know my friends. I know that they're out there. Like, I know that they were having these conversations. It just existed. Facebook kept that in a world away from me, so I only had to deal with the pleasant Beto stuff, which is interesting to me. Like, we are really not seeing what everyone else is. You know, you can have a conversation, and maybe I could just go and click on it and look at it and look at your Facebook history and see it, but Facebook isn't going to show it to me, and so I'm probably not going to click on it. And so you are, in essence, your opinion is hidden from me. I have no idea how you feel about something, and that's a very weird sensation.
Yeah, I think that's very true. We're kind of stuck in what maybe some of our friends think, or some opinions that Facebook might think reaffirms, you know, our beliefs. But yeah, I don't know what the algorithms are. I don't understand how that came to be. But I certainly have witnessed that too, that there's, you know, a certain number of people are maybe not speaking more loudly than others, but for some reason their thoughts or opinions are being showcased more, I guess.
It's frustrating as well because I really hate Facebook. I don't want to be on Facebook. And yet I have to be for stuff that I do. So I might as well be on it anyway. And I just end up going down the holes and I'm just as bad as everybody else. And I know that I should know better, but there we go.
Yeah. For me, it's a great resource. I mean, I love Facebook. But yeah, there are certain people, you know, that you see over and over again in your feed or whatnot. And yeah, if you are looking for, you know, to broaden your horizons, it can be kind of tricky.
Yeah, I think that they said that 90% of your Facebook feed comes from like 20 to 25 people that you interact with fairly often. And then the other, they just kind of cycle in some other people occasionally, and that's how they filter out, and it changes every once in a while. But for the most part, you're just standing in a room with the same people all the time, even if you have 1,000 friends. That's interesting to me.
I call it screaming into an empty room, because you're not influencing anyone who's going to walk in or out of that room.
No.
So, you know, it only gets you so far.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, certainly with some of the individual and some of the move forward stuff that I do belong to, some of the things that people were saying, and just to me, you know, I might even want to fight them, because it's like some of the stuff that you're, some of the ways that you're going about this stuff is maybe not necessarily the most adult way to do stuff.
Oh, I think, yeah, no, definitely.
People. Right, right.
Yeah, but, definitely.
But everybody in these groups just thinks that it's the best idea in the world, and you just, like, wow.
Yeah.
Like, we really are in these tiny little echo chambers.
Can I go back to your original
yes.
question about the kind of what's happening at the national level? Is, you know, watching the last 18 or so months, it's been really interesting to see the deep blue metropolitan regions push the Democratic Party to the left, and then you've got these rural communities who are, you know, have been traditionally conservative Republican strongholds. You know, they're not going for the Democratic Socialist, but they're going for the, you know, the moderate Republican or moderate Democrat. So we're seeing a little bit of a shift there. I mean, take Colorado, for example. No one's actually at the national level I've seen in the last 12 hours or so has really been talking about Colorado, but Colorado's historically been a deep purple state with a split House and Senate at the state level, and we've had a fairly moderate governor and Governor Hickenlooper. And Colorado, the Democratic Party and the voters, clean sweep on the top of the ticket for Democrats. You know, we've got our first openly gay governor. We've got one of the first women, a Secretary of State. We've got a Democratic Treasurer. We've got a Democratic Attorney General. So we're seeing, and then they took back the state Senate with 5 women. Women now are the majority caucus in the Colorado State Senate.
Really?
So,
I did not realize that.
So you see the transition. So I, t- t- to your reference of Texas, it's exciting to see the work that Beto did, because they're getting there, right? They're becoming more purple.
You know, this is a state that Obama won by 40. I'm sorry, Obama did not win. Obama took 45% of Texas in 2008 against John McCain. I think that it's never been quite as red as people think that it is. But yeah, it's nice to see people step up and start to think that maybe they can have their voices heard a little bit more.
Yeah, and I think we'll see that in, you know, traditionally historic red states, as we'll start to see that progression move from red to purple and then purple to blue. But, you know, it's all about, you know, getting there, but then not going backwards. So we have to continue the work and keep pushing forward.
May I say, by the way, as a gay man who was growing up in, again, a fairly conservative area, it's great to see an openly gay governor. From a very young age, politics was always really interesting to me, but being gay, like, you just, like, you didn't see it, and you just thought, well, you know, the only gay politicians you ever see are people getting taken down by scandal who are supposed to be married, and so, you know, that's not a very good look. To see that, you know, young gay people will find that accessible now because they do see leaders who are gay and, you know, they are the political and civic leaders of their communities. I think that that's wonderful. And I'm super jealous of all the kids, of all the young gay kids who are growing up today, who are going to see that level of acceptance from their communities. That's really awesome.
It's really exciting. I feel like being kind of in the thick of it. And, you know, I'm originally from Colorado and have worked in the political realm for 6 or 7 years there before I came out here. And so it's exciting to see my friends and colleagues that, you know, their decades, 2 decades, 3 decades worth of work, you know, finally paying. 2 decades, 3 decades worth of work, you know, finally paying off. We all have to remember that this is the long game, and to truly be effective and to truly move our country forward is not just in one election, but in your entire lifetimes.
Speaking of long game, Amanda, so the Democrats have taken back the House. Ostensibly, our next speaker is going to be our former speaker, that is Nancy Pelosi, who is very popular in San Francisco. She used to be my congresswoman. She's not very popular out here. How do you feel Speaker Pelosi is going to play to the people who voted for Antonio Delgado?
Well, to the people, that's tricky. Yeah, you know, she's in some ways she's sort of become a caricature of the, you know, this idea of the left and the, you know, the West Coast.
Whether that's earned or not,
it seems to be that she, for better or worse, she's gonna have that sort of that title. So yeah, I don't people that were voting, there were some ads that were saying that, you know, that Antonio Delgado was Pelosi's candidate, but I don't think, you know, from speaking with voters, I don't think that they voted for Delgado because, by the virtue of him, whether that's true or not, him being Pelosi's candidate, I think they really were genuinely excited for Delgado. And you said this, I think, very well. You know, he's sort of grown into himself with this campaign, and I think you saw that from his speech last night, which was very measured and poised, and he did look,
he looked congressional.
He looked the part. I don't think it really matters locally much about Pelosi in that way. People really just seem to respond to Delgado. So we'll see how that plays out. I don't think I heard a single word about Pelosi after all those ads yesterday.
Good to hear. Do we think that she is going to be the Speaker of the House? I assume she's the odds-on favorite.
You know, it's interesting. You know, she is a very controversial representative from California for us here in New York. And I think that, you know, the new Congress will have elections at the end of this month, and I think there will be some other representatives who are going to go for it, and they're going to pitch their case. And I think it's, you know, it rests upon us as citizens to communicate to Congressman-elect Delgado that, you know, when you walk into that room to cast your vote, you know, these are our wishes, and we have to communicate with him just like we would Congressman Faso, and make sure that our voices are heard to the best of our ability, and so he can cast his vote that he believes will best represent us here in the 19th district.
Very carefully said, and so let me rephrase and see if I can throw a few more minds out here for you. If you were going to pick as a strategist for the Democratic Party, who is going to be the speaker for the next 2 years, would you pick Nancy Pelosi because of her management experience in the past? Or would you say maybe it's time for you to step down and be a guiding voice to a new speaker?
I'm going to speak personally.
Yes.
And in my opinion, she has been a brilliant strategist. She has held the line for us in this current presidency. I believe that without her experience and her grit, that we would be in far worse conditions and situation. I think that she does have something of value to continue her leadership as the speaker, but I also don't know enough about some of the other congresspeople across this nation who may be able to exert the same, if not more, leadership experience to really continue to hold the line and to continue to push back against the executive branch right now. And so I think that if, you know, we vote to trust our representatives to vote, you know, in favor of us, and I have to put that trust in Delgado. And if I was to cast that vote, I think I would vote for her because I think she's the best that I know of that we got right now to continue to push back. But let's see who else is out there. Let's see who else has got it.
You know, for me, it kind of feels the same way that the primary did. Like, who are people most going to respond to? The way that Bob Mueller's investigation is going, the way that the Russia investigation is going, it's a good possibility that articles of impeachment are going to be brought up. So whether it's a pie-in-the-sky thing or not, people are also going to have in the back of their mind, like, is the Speaker of the House going to be taking over the Oval Office? And I think that is a question that, because they're asking, maybe we should find someone who is more palatable to a large swath of the country. Because I don't think that Nancy Pelosi would say, oh, well, now I'm in. Let me run again in 2020. I could totally win. She couldn't. But it would be... It is worth our while to have someone in there who could, you know.
I agree, and I also think that, you know, we need to look beyond this as well, you know.
Right.
Is we have to start cultivating new leaders. I think that's something that I have seen in, you know, in my mentors, is there's a lot of people who don't have a mentor or a leader who's cultivating the next line of folks.
Right.
And I think that's something that, you know, Senator Feinstein or, you know, Nancy Pelosi, who are their people? Who are they cultivating? Who are they, you know, who are the assembly candidates and the electeds? Who are the state senators who could come up, who could step up and truly be that leader to fill in those shoes when, you know, Congresswoman Pelosi is done?
They could be walking in the door right now. sorry, the studio door just phantom open. You know, one of the things that is interesting to me about covering local politics, and Amanda, you probably noticed this as well, is that the more attention people are paying to local politics and the better people they're electing to those, I don't want to say the bottom, but those first tier, you know, elected positions, the better people they're going to have percolating up through the ranks. And you know, it's so important. This is why it's so important to me for people to pay attention to all of these local elections, the county supervisor, the coroner, the alderman.
And then I would say too, you know, the biggest issue we may have is just a lack of people willing to run for those positions. I mean, we really don't have a lot of competition locally for some of these positions that have been held for years on end.
Do we have one? Was it two alderman positions for the wards that were competitive in the general this last year?
Yeah, I think it was fifth ward, maybe a couple. Only a couple, really. I mean, and the mayor ran unopposed, really. I mean, we really could benefit from some more people stepping up locally. But people are really engaged in Columbia County, and that's why I really love covering this area, because it, you know, really makes you step up, and you're writing for some intelligent people, so you got to meet that. But yeah.
Would you have just a second?